This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Life Will Be the Death of Me and You Too by Chelsea Handler. Read for you by Chelsea Handler. This book is dedicated to my future husband with love. Where have I been all my life? I don't remember the actor, and I don't remember the movie, but I remember it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I had just taken a couple hits off my vape pen. I needed to load my Pix account, which held pre-released movies that I was expected to screen before a star of one of the movies was a guest on my Netflix talk show. I was sitting on one of my overpriced chaise lounges, the kind that celebrities and Russians purchase for their bedrooms, when I found myself once again unable to convert the TV that descends from the ceiling from Apple TV to Pix. Rich people have descending smart televisions. The idea is that they descend silently and gracefully from the ceiling, but because I am nouveau riche, rich, mine sounds more like a helicopter landing. I'd like to blame my inability to change the mode of my television to Pix on the fact that I was stoned, but that would be a lie. I'd be even less capable if I was sober. I called my assistant Brandon at his house to tell him to tell my other assistant Tanner, who was downstairs in my house, to come upstairs and help me with the television. I hung up the phone. I looked down at the table and saw the vape pen. How many more hits of marijuana would I need to get through this movie? I knew things had hit a new low or high, depending on how you looked at the situation. I picked up the iPad that controls the TV along with everything else in my house, from the window shades to the exterior lights in my backyard to my pulse, probably, and tried to pretend that I was troubleshooting so that Tanner would think I had at least tried to figure it out on my own, as if that had ever happened before. How did I become so useless, and how many assistants did I actually have? Answer, two, Brandon and Tanner. Brandon is gay and has an incredible attention to detail. Tanner is straight and, before he met me, thought that the Four Seasons was a weather pattern. Before I met Tanner, I thought Venmo was an online liquor store. Tanner was now upstairs standing behind the chaise I was sitting on. I wondered if he could smell the weed I just smoked, and if so, what did he think of me? Did he realize that most television hosts don't even make the time to watch each movie and TV show to prepare for each of their upcoming guests? Did he understand that I was a consummate professional who went to great lengths to get ready for my show? Or did he think that I was just some rich, lucky white bitch who continued to fall upward? No, that wasn't quite right. I doubt he was thinking in terms of race, too. White people surely weren't thinking about skin color. I didn't want to watch another stupid fucking movie that I didn't care about, and I really didn't want to interview another action star bloviating about his motivation for playing a half-man, half-mermaid. I just didn't care, and I wasn't doing anyone any favors by pretending that I did. Did I ever care? The answer is yes. There was a time when all of this mattered to me. There was a time when being famous and having this kind of success and money and having a TV show was what drove me to want more and more and more. And now I found myself exhausted and ashamed by the meaninglessness of it all. I remember coming home a couple of weeks before the 2016 election on a windy fall night, which for Los Angeles is rare. Anytime there's weather in Los Angeles, even rain, it's exciting. The constant sunshine can start to grate on your nerves. I went up to my bedroom, opened up my sliding glass doors, grabbed my vape pen, and turned on some Neil Young. I lay on my bed in the dark, watching the wind blow my bedroom drapes around, hearing the ruffling of the leaves, and watching the lanterns that hang from my backyard trees swinging into each other, thinking, if there's an electrical fire, I hope the dogs will at least bark to wake me up. But overall, my thought was, this is fucking awesome. This is exactly what I'd hoped adulthood would be. No kids, no husband, no responsibilities, just a TV show on Netflix and whatever else I felt like doing whenever I felt like doing it. Not trapped, not stuck, not dependent on a single person but myself, free to be you and me. I couldn't believe how lucky my life had turned out, how many of my dreams had come true, and also my good fortune in being alive during this time in history, the year we were going to elect our first female president. I suppose I could blame my state of mind on the election of Donald Trump, so I will. I have the Trump family and their horrifying personalities and veneers to thank for my midlife crisis. Along with more than half the population of the world, I couldn't grasp how in this day and age, we elected a man who insulted Mexicans and women and Muslims and veterans and disabled people and everyone else he has insulted since. The contrast in decency between Barack Obama and Donald Trump was too much for me to bear, like electing Snooki to the Senate. Now people were seriously talking about Dwayne The Rock Johnson running for president. How on earth did we get here? Although, if I am being honest, at that point in time or at any other time during the entire Trump presidency, I would have preferred an actual Rock. How could Americans have turned their back on decency, and why was I so misinformed? How did I not know that this outcome was even a possibility? What was I missing? I kept hearing the word elitists, that everyone in California and New York lived in a bubble, that the election of this lunatic was a result of all of us not knowing anything about the rest of the country. That didn't ring true for me. I had traveled all over the country doing stand-up for so many years. I had been to every major and some minor cities multiple times. I wasn't an elitist. My father was a used car dealer. I didn't have a trust fund or wealthy parents. We weren't allowed to answer the phone growing up because more often than not, it would be a bill collector. I had $400 when I drove across the country alone to move to Los Angeles and then was broke for 7 years living paycheck to paycheck while simultaneously getting fired from every waitressing job I ever had. I worked for everything I have and never even went to college. How could I be an elitist without ever having gone to college? And then, oh, wait a minute, now I remember. I grew up wanting to get as far away from the life my parents had given me as possible. I had created a life in which there was a zero tolerance policy for any discomfort. I could handle physical discomfort like dental work or elective surgery to make my thighs smaller, but not any discomfort related to not having money. Sure, I was just scraping by on those cross-country trips in the beginning of my stand-up career, barely making enough money from small comedy clubs to cover my hotel room for the week. But after a few years, I was earning more money, and the clubs turned into theaters. And then arenas with private planes and chauffeur cars, sometimes for less than 24 hours, and then on to the next city. So here I was again, not taking into account the optics, or for that matter, the reality of my own entitlement. I had become exactly what I'd always wanted to be, an elitist. I did live in a bubble inside a bigger bubble, which was inside an even bigger bubble. Three bubbles, two assistants, two cleaning ladies, or more like my nannies, a driver, a pool guy, a landscaper, a florist, a houseman. What is a houseman, you ask? Someone who walks the dogs and polishes the outdoor furniture and cleans up the dog shit outside. Basically, an outdoor butler. When was the last time I cleaned up dog shit? Probably the last time I flew coach. I hated having these thoughts. I hated it because something clicked in the process of making these associative leaps. I realized that I'd made a career of overhydrating people with my honesty, yet I was being dishonest with myself, which left me operating in a deficit of truth. Now that I was aware of this situation, I would have to do something about it. I couldn't carry on the way I'd been carrying on, just coasting and cashing checks for essentially being a loudmouth. I took another hit of my vape. What I really wanted to do was watch the news, even though the news was giving me diarrhea. The whole administration was giving me diarrhea. My outrage was high. I had spent the year after the election being sucked into the vortex of news cycles that accompanied Donald Trump's ascendancy and my subsequent mental hernia. The news was like a high-speed merry-go-round that never slowed down long enough to figure out when it was safe to hop on or off. So like everything in my life thus far, I hopped on and stayed on. I had spent the better part of my day in a wormhole, Googling pictures of young Robert Mueller because I was developing strong sexual feelings toward him as well as his investigation. In an interesting plot twist, it turns out Bob Mueller is even hotter in his early 70s than he was when he was in the Marines. I was more attracted to present-day Bob Mueller than I would have been had I been alive during NAM. The guy fucking kills me. Who is hotter than Bob Mueller? Daniel Day-Lewis playing Bob Mueller? Maybe. But the jury is out until that movie is released and Daniel Day-Lewis gives up his shoe cobbling for a year. I mean, my God, just stop it with the cobbling. Just act. You're great at it. People adore you. No one's talking about your shoes. Maybe your wife, but I doubt it. Bob Mueller was the only hope I had that Donald Trump and that terrible vampire family he spawned would end up in prison. The investigation into Donald Trump and his conspiring with Russia and all the other crimes I'm sure he'll be indicted for made me realize what real men look like. They look like Bob Mueller, a 73-year-old with a six-pack, possibly an eight-pack, underneath that suit. You can see it through his shirt when he walks. He's ripped. Keeping your shit together is what that's called. a prosecutor, a Marine, and the director of the FBI? How on earth is any woman worth her salt meant to control herself around him and not sit directly on his face? And then that hair part? Very few 70-year-old men have a head of hair like that, and if anyone knows their way around 70-year-old men, it's me. They're my core demographic. The thickness, the salt and pepper, it's one thing after another with this patriot. My best friend Mary and I have spent many a night deliberating about what he drinks when he gets home after a long day. Was it a scotch on the rocks or a scotch neat? One ice cube, Mary would say, and it would be Macallan. People who use one ice cube usually annoy me, but this was different. I knew that Bob Mueller knew better than I did, and if he wanted to use one ice cube, then he was trying to accomplish something different with his libation, something that only a scotch or whiskey drinker knew about. I would be willing to switch over to scotch or whiskey, and even use one ice cube for the rest of my life, if the reward meant seeing Donald Trump dragged out of the White House topless, handcuffed, in his tighty-whities while his hairpiece detached from the tape on his head and flew around like a cyclone landing in the Rose Garden. On the subject of ICE, once we sort out this Donald Trump situation, I would like my social activism to focus solely on the integrity of ICE. Temperature and ICE are two of my most learned subject matters. I feel strongly that everybody needs to get on the same page with ICE. It's an international issue, and there aren't enough people taking it seriously. Just like there's an appropriate glass for every libation, there's an appropriate amount of ICE as well. It's called, whatever you're thinking, double it. If you've ever been to Europe, then you know what I'm talking about. No one wants a warm cocktail, and the only reason Europeans tolerate the ICE situation there is because it's not high on the European Union's list of priorities. Two ice cubes in a mixed drink glass do not even begin to cool your drink. The fewer the ice cubes, the less consolidation the ice has. Therefore, you may as well just add water. If anyone wanted a vodka and soda with a splash of water, it would be its own thing by now. Cocktails should be cold. Cubes. Plural. Not the wrapper. Mary's ice in her freezer always has corn mixed in it. She says it's because she has three little girls, but I don't see how that correlates to corn in her ice maker. Anyway, when I go to Mary's, I always have a vodka with corn on the rocks. She says that the ice and corn are both frozen, and then I should just think of the corn as extra ice. I'm not embarrassed by my feelings for Robert Mueller. Surprised, maybe, but not embarrassed. I am legitimately attracted to him and everything he stands for. I respect the shit out of him, and I suspect there will be a lot of people naming their baby boys Bob after this whole shit show is over. Who would have thought a name like Bob would finally take off? Boxers or briefs, I asked. Mary was aghast. Chelsea, Bob Mueller is a Marine. Boxers, obviously. And don't think for a second he's not also wearing a Fruit of the Loom undershirt to sleep in as well. Snug and tidy. That's how Marines like it. A wife beater? Those ribbed ones like what gang members wear? No, dummy. He's not rolling his face off on Molly in Ibiza. It's a crew neck Fruit of the Loom undershirt, short sleeved. Think Hanes for men. Bob Mueller is not wearing a fucking tank top. Mary's father was a Marine, and Mary knows more than I do regarding just about everything, unless, of course, I tell her about something like a diet that she dismisses and then finds out about it months later from another friend and tells me about it like I wasn't the one who told her about it in the first fucking place. So more often than not, I defer to her, and I had to accept these musings as cold, hard facts. The only thing I knew about Marines was that they had a strong relationship with water, which, it turns out, they don't. That's the Navy. My thoughts were as follows. Marine life equals sea life. Marines equal water army. I'm a literal thinker. At least that's what my new psychiatrist tells me, or that's what I tell him. Semper Fi is a term that Marines use that means always loyal, I told Mary. It's the motto of the United States Marines. How hot is that? Yes, I know that. And please don't start throwing that term around. One, you're not Latin. And two, you're not a Marine. Copy that, I told her. Knowing full well I would be adding Semper Fi to my rotation of words and phrases that no one has used in 50 years. You know he still does push-ups every morning and never eats unless it's for fuel, Mary added, twirling her hair. He's that guy. Oh, it's all so fucking hot, I said, scouring her liquor cabinet for some Macallan, eager to see how it would taste with frozen corn. Imagining Bob Mueller sitting in his boxers and a little boy's Hanes undershirt with short sleeves while drinking Macallan on the rock, probably in a leather club chair, made me feel like Bob Mueller and I had a lot more in common than anyone would guess, even me. I imagined us playing Clue together in a cozy cabin in the Catskills, learning entirely new strategies to a game I thought I had already intellectually mastered. I understand Bob Mueller is married and unavailable, so I would like to go on the record and say I respect that. while also remaining deeply attracted to him. It wouldn't matter if he was interested in me or not. I don't need people to like me in order for me to like them. That's a new philosophy I've been toying with, and I like it. Through the months of thick fog and despair after the election, he was the one bright spot. He also represented a seminal moment for me personally. I had finally found the first Republican I could see myself being penetrated by. Mueller time. Back to my midlife crisis. There's a line I'd written down from Viktor Frankl's memoir about surviving the Holocaust, Man's Search for Meaning, that stopped me cold when I read it. Stop thinking about what you expect out of life and start thinking about what life expects out of you. That was a book putter downer. It was a look up at the sky and wonder, where the fuck have I been all my life moment. My dad used to tell me that there was always one line in every book that summed up the entire book. He also said that even if you don't understand everything you're reading in an article or a book or even in a conversation, to try to take one piece of information away from it. That way you've left with something new to add to your brain. At the time, I was only 8, but I was already sick and tired of my father forcing me to read so many hard books, The Fountainhead, East of Eden, Anna Karenina, that I would always look for the first line that I thought would give him the impression that I had read the books he assigned. This was that line from Viktor Frankl. What does life expect out of me? How lost was I if that question had never occurred to me? And it hadn't. I had to read it to think it. What a fucking dummy I was, rewarding myself over and over again with homes and cars and vacations and gross extravagance. I justified all of it because I worked for everything I had. I came from nothing, I told myself. For years, that was my story. Work hard, fight hard, don't give up, you can do anything, you deserve this. The idea that I came from nothing is a joke. My parents were disappointing in many respects, but I always felt loved by a lot of people. I never went hungry, I never struggled, I was white, pretty, and Jewish, and had a ton of misplaced self-confidence, so life got easier the more focused I became. I got to Hollywood and was rewarded for all of the above. It took a few years, but I never thought it wasn't going to happen, and people who like me can say it's because of talent, but talent is a non-issue. There are too many untalented people who are successful and too many talented people who aren't. Talent is neither here nor there. Becoming famous just seemed like the easiest way to become wealthy without going to college. That was my mindset. It was a lot of luck and a lot of privilege. My life was a bubble. That's exactly what it had become, a big, vapid bubble. What were my ties to being famous, to being a celebrity? Wealth and fame existed as a couple in my mind. They went together. Did that mean I could still have one without the other? And if so, which one would I choose? Was this my whole life? No, it can't be. Do I get to fall in love again with a man? No, a man can't help me with this. You got yourself here. So the question is, what am I going to do with myself now? What is my enough? I've always been generous, but that's always come easily to me. It's easy to give. If anything, it feeds my ego to give to others. Real generosity is also showing up when you don't feel like it. Sacrificing your own happiness in exchange for someone else's. Was I willing to do that? What am I willing to do that I really don't want to do? Is that something I'm even capable of? I never had to care about the state of the world before. The world was a vague thought and a whimsical fancy. That was for the adults. I thought by traveling to so many different countries, I was doing my due diligence. That by edifying myself with other cultures and sharing my experiences on camera and on my show, I was somehow making a worthy contribution to society. America wasn't a problem. There was no problem. We had elected a black president. Racism and feminism were fights we had already won. America was being handled by people smarter and more skilled in politics, and they took care of this stuff so that people like me could live the American dream and remain blissfully ill-informed. I had spent my adulthood on a cigarette boat going 100 miles per hour, and now I felt like I had somehow become marooned on one of those terrible, all-inclusive Carnival cruise ships. Tanner fixed my TV and awkwardly put the iPad on my lap. I wondered if Tanner was the awkward one, or maybe I was just stoned too much of the time and I was the awkward one. And if that was right, why was I stoned all the time? Then I remembered that I was coming out with my own line of weed, and the reason I was stoned all the time was because I was doing research. That's a true story. I also have the Trump family to thank for my newfound love of vaping and edibles. I had to get stoned to watch the news because alcohol and outrage don't mix well. A hat on a hat. Time speeds up as it goes by. Someone explained to me that there's a mathematical reason for this. As you age, each year becomes a smaller percentage of the life you've already lived. I'm 42 as I write this. 1 year now represents a small percentage of my 42 years, about 2.38%. But when I was 8, 1 year was a really long time. It was an eighth of my entire life. This is why summer lasted about 4 years when you were a kid. This may be why I now feel an urgency to know more, to do more, and to be more. Don't get me wrong. I don't believe life is too short. I believe life is too long. It's exhausting. I don't fear dying. I want people to know that. If I die early, it's not some tragedy. I'd be relieved. My life has been an incredible adventure. I have $250,000 set aside for my funeral because I want everyone to have one big fucking party in my honor. I want to have a great funeral filled with dancing and little people, mushrooms, and little people on mushrooms. I want it to be a celebration for all the people who love me and for all the people who are happy to see me go. Note to self, you should probably put that money towards something more meaningful than a party for yourself, like maybe Syrian refugees or the NAACP, just a thought. However, in the meantime, between now and then, this is my attempt at taking stock of how I got here, where I've been, and where it is I'm going. What exactly it is that I might bring to the table to answer the question that Viktor Frankl forced me to ask myself. Do I have the conviction to examine myself unflinchingly to reveal the good and the bad, the ugly and the beautiful? The answer is yes. I have a lot to be embarrassed about, and I intend to advertise it. I'm sick of my voice, of my ambition, of my entitlement. I'm sick of not knowing more, and I'm embarrassed it took me this long to recognize it. Life has been too easy. I've gotten almost everything I've ever wanted, and I'm 42. Something smells funny. And after all is said and done, I'd like to be cremated and have my ashes scattered over Bob Mueller's grave, or inside it, or his inside mine, or me, or in one of Daniel Day-Lewis's clogs. Thank you. Room temperature water. There was a time in my life when astrology and psychics, not to be confused with physics, fascinated me. But as a general rule, I think it's all a bunch of bullshit. Meditation seems to work for some people, while medication works for others, which explains why it's very difficult for me to sit still with my eyes closed for any length of time without Rohypnol. I'm all for people being spiritual, but I'm leery of anyone who mentions it more than once in a single sitting. Unless, of course, one is on a spiritual retreat, which I hope to God I will never be. If there even is a God. Jury's out on that one, too, at least until the rapture, an event I'm convinced will end up taking place at the Hollywood Bowl. I believe in spirituality as a component of your lifestyle. The problem is that spiritual people can sometimes be giant assholes. Madonna doesn't make me want to practice Kabbalah. She makes me wonder what on earth she has on them that they are willing to let her be their most famous brand ambassador. At least Tom Cruise is a good frontman for Scientology because he seems nice, even though he's obviously out of his fucking tree. I feel spiritual when I'm on mushrooms. I'm not into rocks and crystals and chakras and healers. I just think everyone is looking for something, and it seems like some people will settle on the first ray of sun or glimmer of hope they bump into. Los Angeles is a tricky place for vulnerable people. Hourly, you hear words like gratitude, universe, and manifest, and terms like micro panic attack and artisanal deodorant. It's a place consumed with trends and fads and avocados and kale, but everything has a shelf life. There will be a point when the women and gay population of Los Angeles will turn their backs on avocados and kale, claiming they cause both cancer and erectile dysfunction, only to turn their attention towards some new colonic hydrotherapist slash mystic who convinces everyone that a steady diet of fried calamari is the new anti-inflammatory food for the ages. It will quickly appear on the menu of upscale restaurants, and there will be stores selling pre-packaged fresh calamari for $11 a serving. It's hard to take anything or anyone seriously after a while. I needed to talk to someone, but I was embarrassed that I needed to talk to someone. I had spent years skirting the issue of therapy based on the fact that my life was working out pretty well, minus an emotionally stable relationship with someone of the opposite sex. To anyone who would query, I would say, oh, I'm better off single. I don't want to be tethered to anyone. I'm not a relationship girl. My most recent favorite line was, I'm just more high-functioning as a single person. After all, if 90% of people were in relationships, then clearly I was special if I had managed to avoid one. I was 42 when I finally saw a real psychiatrist. I had seen doctors and therapists before, but never really with the intention of fixing anything that ran deep. I didn't have the mental equipment to articulate my pain and let someone see me for anything other than what I had become, strong. I was strong, and because of that strength, I wasn't about to sit in a doctor's office and cry. Crying for other people was fine. Crying for myself, about myself, was out of the question. Vulnerability in my mind was akin to carbohydrates. I wasn't willing to go there unless it was alcohol-induced. What I didn't yet know was that when I was crying for other people, I was absolutely crying for myself. And another thing, therapy always seemed too narcissistic, like navel-gazing. My whole entire life was about me. I've had eponymously named TV shows for the past 12 years and a whole team of people who worked for me. It seemed gross to sit around and spend more time talking about myself, never mind the fact that I was sick and tired of hearing the sound of my own voice. I felt like I should switch from talking to writing, or at the very least, tweeting. I just wanted to write or tweet everything, including my TV show. I looked at therapy as a horrible option. It would require listening to myself speak rather than just speaking and having someone else edit it. I didn't know how to ask for help from anyone. I was surviving. My brother died when I was 9, my mother when I was 32, after years of fighting cancer. My brother's death made us stronger as a family. I thought these tragedies were the reason for my tenacity. If anyone needed a strong friend, I was the one they could lean on. Give me someone else's crisis and I could fix it. I could handle anything. I was tough. It never occurred to me to wonder why I'd heard so many times that people were scared of me. Who would ever want to be that tough, is what one MFCC marriage, family, and child counselor said to me when I'd said all of the above to him. I wasn't interested in rehashing my past, only in improving my present-day self. I said, I just need to get better at being me. Every therapist I saw before I reached the age of 42 made me feel like I was running in place. I would go for a period of time, and then I would eventually get bored. Often I knew I was running circles around them. Some therapists were just not the right fit, and some of them were good but felt more like enablers than instructors, and I wanted to be taught how to be better at being a whole person. I wanted to break my pattern of ending friendships and relationships on a dime because someone did something that I found unforgivable. I would go to the mat for my friends and sometimes for people I barely knew, and when it came time for them to return the favor or defend me, and they weren't capable of the same bullish determination I had shown them, the earth became scorched, and I wrote them off forever. Everything with me had always been black and white, life or death. I wanted more gray. I wanted to learn how to forgive. On an episode of my show about education, I interviewed a neuropsychiatrist and researcher named Dan Siegel, who'd written several books on developing brains, including one that focused on adolescent brains. I wanted to know when brains develop, at what age you learn the most, whether it's possible to increase your IQ, and at what age drugs and alcohol do the most damage in terms of slowing down your learning process. The last question I slipped in about 3 or 4 times throughout the conversation until I finally got the answer I wanted, which was that my brain had fully developed before any brain damage had occurred and that any extracurricular activities I was up to were just fine. At least that's what my takeaway was. In addition to writing several books on childhood brain development and meditation, Dan lectured all over the world about mindfulness and being present, and he explained the brain to me in a very linear, non-obscure way that I could understand. With pictures. A couple of months after the election, I had Brandon call Dan and set up an appointment. I spent our first session talking to him about meditation, how to slow down, how to be less reactive, and not end friendships every time someone hurt my feelings. I explained to him my interest in wanting to know more about the amygdala, hippocampus, and prefrontal cortex. The science of the brain would be a good non-emotional buffer while I figured out if this doctor was smarter than me. I like my language literal. I like logic. I can't follow anything abstract or math for that matter. Physics can also go fuck itself, I told Dan. Also, feel free to use metaphors. I'm into those. I kept blathering on like someone who was on a first date but was too embarrassed to admit that she was on a first date, even though she was at a restaurant with a stranger she had met online. I tend to lean toward my own experiences and not think outside of that perspective. It's called being selfish. It's why I'm here, I told Dan. To find out more about others and less about what I like, to become less self-centered, more evolved and involved with things I know nothing about. I'm starved for a real conversation about struggle, not who the best spray tanner in town is. I am officially dehydrated from my life. Okay, he nodded. Tell me about that. I've decided to take this year off and throw myself into helping women and people of color get elected because I believe we are in an emergency situation in this country and I want to be part of the solution, not the problem. In order to do that, I feel like I have to get real about how spoiled and entitled I've become. I read somewhere that in order to be of use to others, you need to clean out your own injuries. I exhaled. Or maybe I dreamed it. I don't know. Dan looked at me curiously and asked me what it was exactly that I wanted to tackle, what I didn't like about myself. Well, I think we have to start with the fact that I can't do very simple things. Okay, he replied with his hands folded in his lap, legs crossed, sitting about 3 feet away from me. I took a deep inhale and then let it rip. I'd say my biggest weakness is my short fuse and my lack of ability to do any menial tasks. I've spent the last 15 years being paid to talk for a living, so I know a lot of words and I have a lot of facial expressions and a lot of free clothes. I want to become more self-sufficient this next year. I'd like to be able to understand all these apps that everyone uses, or at least know how to download them without asking one of my assistants to do it. I'd like to know how to use the coffee machine in my kitchen. I don't drink coffee, but I'd still like to know anyway. I'd like to know how to clean up dog urine when one of my dogs pees on the rug instead of going and sleeping in another bedroom. I can, in fact, clean up urine when it's on a hard surface, but that rarely happens because I believe my dogs are acutely aware of my impotence, and like typical teenagers, they like to fuck with me. I'd like to not take scalding hot showers every day I'm home because I have no idea how to change the temperature on my own, even though it has been demonstrated for me numerous times. For the record, my shower is very complicated, but I can only take a shower when my cleaning lady is home, which means we've showered together on multiple occasions. Dan was listening intently and seemed to be taking me very seriously, and I wanted to disabuse him of the notion that I took myself seriously. I thought about telling him that the night before meeting him, I slept with a towel around my head because I couldn't figure out how to turn the music off in the house, but in that moment, I decided not to pile on. "But that's not all of me," I told him. "In many moments, I have a romantic and hopeful temperament, but it usually involves being romantic and hopeful for someone else. Also, I never fill with dread, unless in the sense that one dreads things in the way you regret agreeing to do something you wish you hadn't said yes to, or knowing I'm about to sit down and get yelled at. I have that kind of dread. What I mean to say is that I don't have the doom and gloom part. I don't get depressed. I don't have that gene. I am definitely an alarmist, and I like to get myself and others fired up, but I'm not a doomsdayer. I don't think aliens are going to come out of the sky and eat us, or that I'm going to get attacked by birds, or that there's going to be a nuclear war. Well, I do worry about that, but not as an existential threat, more like it will happen, but hopefully I'll be in Spain when it does. I'm also a big proponent of being responsible for your own happiness," I continued, "and have always had a surfeit of dopamine to go along with it. So the only thing I really want to work on is my temper and impulse control, or at the very least, behavior modification. I'm basically looking for a behaviorist, like for a puppy. I'd like to learn how to make my point without yelling." Our first few sessions consisted of Dan guiding me through meditation, after which I would spend the rest of the time bitching about Donald Trump and what a piece of shit he was. I was paying someone hundreds of dollars an hour to complain about Donald Trump, which seemed like the exact right move. I would have paid him double. I had definitely paid for far worse in my life. I knew people were getting sick and tired of my anger directed toward the 2016 election and the daily horrifying cabinet appointees and Ivanka and that schmuck Jared and that evil witch they called a press secretary. I couldn't wrap my head around the fact that Sarah Huckabee Sanders and Ivanka Trump had no morality or sense of obligation to the very sex they inhabited to stand up and say no more. I needed someone to let me vent privately. I needed someone to help me harness my anger into something positive. In our third session, Dan asked me about my childhood. Just the usual bullshit. My parents were kind of lame. I have 5 brothers and sisters, one of whom died when he was 22, and my mom died a few years ago. I don't really have any sense of time, so it could have been 10 years ago or it could have been 5 years ago. I really don't know. But what I really want to talk about is right now. What can I do right now? Dan looked at me with something in his eyes that I'd seen before from doctors when I mentioned that my brother had died, and that slightly annoyed me because I was paying him to talk about what I wanted to talk about, which was the present, not the past. It felt like pity, and that wasn't something I was interested in being on the receiving end of. Of course I wanted to talk about my brother, but I wasn't about to admit that to a stranger. Now, I know that I was testing him. He was earning my trust. I had to make sure I respected him, and I had to make sure he wasn't going to let me steamroll him. All I knew at the time was that I felt a responsibility to myself and to my friends and to all the other people I loved to keep going to my appointments with him. I didn't always feel like going the same way I felt about meditating, but I felt that it was my duty to start doing more things that I didn't feel like doing. Something was pulling me toward him. It was as if my biological clock were telling me that I needed a psychiatrist before I wouldn't be able to reproduce anymore. It was during our 5th or 6th session that he asked me if I had ever heard of something called the Enneagram. I hadn't. I asked him if it was a heart monitor. It's not. The Enneagram is a psychological system based on certain ancient approaches to viewing our lives. More recently, the philosophy was adapted and popularized in the United States by a number of people as a personality test and a tool for self-discovery. Dan, my therapist, and other physicians and researchers have been using variations of the Enneagram to explore the idea that there is a scientifically recognized brain-based personality pattern that develops and manifests over the course of our lives. Dan applies something called a PDP model, which stands for Patterns of Developmental Pathways. Basically, this method suggests that most people are born with a tendency toward one of three default zones based on how you contend with the separation that occurs when you leave the womb, where you're safe and warm and nourished for 9 months, and are then catapulted into a hospital room with harsh fluorescent lights shining on you, if you're lucky, where you are greeted with a smack on the ass and you have to cry every time you want to eat or are in pain because suddenly that's the only way to communicate your needs, or something like that. Anyway, Dan says how you navigate this transition from the inner peace of the womb to the struggles of the world outside of it is an important factor in determining your personality. I gave him a skeptical look. When he asked me what I was thinking, I told him that this sounded very LA. "What do you mean?" he asked earnestly. "You know, I mean, are people really holding on to their births all these years later? I just find that a little hard to believe. Now people are going to be pissed about being born. It's a little much, no?" He cocked his head to the side, and I didn't know if it was meant to challenge me or if he was sincerely confused by my Los Angeles reference. "I just have a hard time comprehending why rehashing the past repeatedly, time and time again, is beneficial to people who just need to get up and move the fuck on. I mean, get over it. There are people being blown out of their homes in Syria. We have a president who's rolling back women's rights, and innocent black men are getting shot and killed by police officers every day. It's like, get out of your own asshole and look around." The irony that I was sitting in a psychiatrist's office complaining about people who sit in a psychiatrist's office was not lost on either of us. We locked eyes with an intense stare because what I had admitted was more profound than anything I was blabbering on about. I had sought out the help of a professional because I knew, on a cellular level, that I wouldn't be able to help anyone in a real meaningful way until I was able to sit with myself, a place I believed I was too smart to ever have to go. "Okay, that's fair," he said, nodding, understanding where I was coming from. "Just so you know, from my professional experience, I have seen how it has helped a lot of people to understand themselves and the people they love in a deeper way. But we don't have to talk about it. It's totally up to you." I told Dan what my father told me about taking one piece of information away from any conversation, and that one of my desires was to become more open-minded as long as I was learning something, and if this was something he believed in, I was willing to hear him out. "Well, your father sounds like a smart guy," Dan said. "Well, let's not get carried away. I mean, he was and is smart, but he's also a con man who cheated, lied, and probably stole from people. He is the epitome of a used car dealer." "In what way?" "Well, he actually was a used car dealer." Okay. "But please, go on, because I'm here to become less judgmental and more patient, and if I really lose interest in this subject matter, I'll start rolling my eyes, which is also something I'd like to do less frequently." Dan went on to tell me that this default zone is the place you revert to when you feel uncomfortable or nervous or when things don't turn out the way they were supposed to. When you are born in this world, you experience one of three reactions, which sets up your disposition in life. In the Enneagram model, the reactions are located in the head, heart, and gut. Dan and his fellow researchers developed their own model, translating those three areas of the body to emotional states. So fear is head, sadness is heart, and anger is gut. "I'm anger," I told Dan. "Okay. I'm fucking angry and I just don't understand how this man could get elected." Dan told me to just sit with that feeling and not to talk. What I grew to learn was that Dan didn't want me to talk around my anger and pretend it was all about Donald Trump. What Donald Trump represented to me were things being out of control, and when things became unhinged, I became angry because that was my default zone. I realize that many people may think of me as someone who's completely out of control, myself, and they're not wrong. I am out of control, but within boundaries that no one knows about except for me. I thrive in organized chaos. It keeps my juices flowing, and it keeps me paying attention and on my tippy toes. Once the silence had gone on for what seemed to me like an unreasonable amount of time, less than a minute, I needed to break it. Anger makes sense, I admitted. All I ever wanted was financial freedom and independence, and now I have it, but I'm stuck. I'm stuck with what to do next because the whole world is upside down. Until I read Rebecca Solnit and James Baldwin and Ta-Nehisi Coates, I had no idea how many women are beaten and raped every second in this world, or what it means to grow up as a Black person, or any person of color in this country we call the land of the free and the home of the brave. What is wrong with me? How could I be so self-absorbed? I was saying things out loud I hadn't said out loud to anyone before. I spent the last 15 years of my success believing that I picked myself up by my bootstraps and worked my ass off to get where I was. It never occurred to me that I have had an advantage just by being white, that I've never not argued with a police officer when being pulled over for a ticket, while for Black people getting pulled over is a life or death situation. I've been so consumed with my own success and my own personal life that I haven't spent enough time thinking about people outside my lane and what their struggles are. I have shame for my entitlement and for not learning all of this sooner. I feel great shame and great outrage. I'm embarrassed for our entire race, but mostly I'm really embarrassed for myself. By the time I was done with this little diatribe, my eyes were starting to water. I needed to pivot and change topics before the lip quivering kicked in. It would be mortifying to lose my composure in front of a stranger. I was not going to let myself cry. I come on strong, I told Dan. To whom? To anyone who I think needs me. Tell me more about that. I want to fix people. If someone doesn't have friends, I'll introduce them to people. If someone needs money, I'll give them money. If someone is hurt and is going through a breakup in Germany, I'll fly to Germany to be with them. They don't even really have to be a close friend. I would do it for a stranger. I have a boundary issue, I think. Why do I do these things unless I'm making up for some other terrible quality that I'm trying to camouflage? It's too much. I always go too far. I'm like a calf that needs to be faked out with an electric fence inside a bigger electric fence, like a Russian nesting doll. I have to be tricked to stay in bounds like an animal. I hate boundaries. Dan looked at me with concern, but it was concern that I needed. I needed someone who didn't know me to be concerned for me, and it seemed like a more straightforward transaction to pay someone to do it. Okay, so back to the Enneagram, I said. So how you enter this world determines your natural disposition for the rest of your life? Is this astrology adjacent? I don't view it as that, no, but if you are hesitant about diving in further, then we don't have to discuss it at all. You do have a medical degree, right? I do, he nodded, smiling. I've also trained as a researcher, so a lot of the research I've done on the Enneagram with other scientists and other researchers is something I'm very familiar with. If I didn't think it held any merit, I wouldn't be writing about it or talking about it. Okay, calm down, big guy, is what I wanted to say, but I felt at that point he had gotten a full dose of my cynicism, and the truth was that I did want to hear more. Obviously, there are other factors, he said, such as nature and nurture, along with all of the events that happen throughout your early childhood and throughout your life that will shape who you become as a person. But that anger, sadness, or fear will remain deep in your subconscious and will dictate how you react to things in your life that don't go as planned. Dan asked me about my parents' marriage, and I told him it was functionally dysfunctional, that my parents were hard to take seriously as role models, but that my aversion to being married wasn't about my parents' marriage, it was about marriage in general. It just seems outdated. I consider remaining unmarried a victory, I told him. If I had married either of the men I'd thought about marrying, I'd be divorced, therefore ending up as just another statistic. Conversely, remaining married to the same person your entire life seems not only boring, but also like becoming just another statistic. It feels like marriage goes hand in hand with running errands or baking. You don't run errands? Dan asked, slightly confused. I try not to. I worked hard to maintain eye contact with him when I took breaks from rambling so that he would understand I was serious, even if some of the things I said sounded ridiculous. I was serious about getting help for my ridiculousness. Sorry, I know you're married, and it's not an insult, I told him. I just prefer to not do what everyone else is doing. I like to be in the minority. No offense taken, he assured me, smiling slightly. I think I'm more cut out for short flings or long-distance relationships, casual encounters. I don't think I have what it takes to remain interested in someone long-term. The word marriage has always felt to me like the end of fun. Okay, he said, leaning his head to one side. I don't like constraints or restrictions of any kind. I don't like feeling boxed in. A one-on-one beach holiday with someone of the opposite sex is something I'd like to avoid at all costs. I'd rather be alone. At this point in my life, I didn't know if anything I was saying was true or if I had manufactured all these thoughts to protect myself. I'm assuming it's the latter, but the truth of the matter is when it comes to men, I haven't been that impressed with my choices. He asked me why I thought marriage represented the end of fun. I get bored easily, and I also go at things in a wildly immature way. How so? He asked. Like a little girl, everything has to be the most, or the best, or dangerous, or a risk. I take everything too far. I don't know how to just be still, unless I'm lying in bed binge-watching Peaky Blinders, or if I'm at a long, leisurely lunch anywhere pleasant in this world. Then I can sit for hours, but that scenario involves Aperol spritzes and other people who feel as passionately as I do about Aperol spritzes. This is why I can't meditate. Because of Aperol spritzes, he asked? Because I like extremes. I think I'm an extremist. Tell me about that. It's the everything is a possibility phase that I live for. I don't ever want another person making the decisions about where I go or what I do or to be sent down a particular runway I haven't approved. I want to change runways all the time, and I don't like answering to others. I don't like feeling trapped or having to get approval to go on a trip from anyone. I want to do what I want to do when I want to do it. I'm completely fucking spoiled. Okay, talk more about that, he said. I feel like I'm always running a million miles an hour and that I've covered a lot of ground, and I like that my life is so full. I've had so many adventures, but there are never enough. There's too much to see, too many books I haven't read, and too many people that need help. I do feel grateful. When I stop being grateful for something, I usually end it. I stop doing stand-up because I burn myself out. I did too many shows and too much traveling and wrote too many books in a row to be grateful. It became rote. I was becoming devoid of the joy one should have when walking out to a crowd of thousands of people. I grew impatient and irritable, and I felt icky having those thoughts in front of people who had paid money to come see me, all the while dying for it to be over so I could just hang out with whoever was on the road with me. I never enjoyed being on the stage as much as I enjoyed walking off it. I liked the sense of accomplishment and all the great luxurious things that came with it, but once I realized my heart wasn't in it, I felt like I was ripping people off and I was done. What does it feel like to you when you're not running around making yourself busy? Dan asked me, leaning forward in his chair, putting both hands on his knees. I have no idea because I've never done that. This is what I do with everything. I burn the candle at both ends and then I grow bored. Do you think you're running from something? I don't know, because that's how I've always gone through life, I told him. I get sick of people, places, jobs, things. I'm always looking for newness, something fresh, someone new, a stranger, the unknown. I told him that when I was a kid, I was so hungry to grow up and become famous and successful that my entire 20s and half of my 30s were spent in a cycle of feeding that hunger and then looking for something else. I had now reached the burnout phase with my talk show. I was sick of all the things that went along with doing a talk show, the editing, the talent booking, the constant micromanaging, and having to watch myself on camera over and over again. I was over it. Dan asked me about children, and I repeated what I tell everyone who asks. I've never had the urge, and it wouldn't be a good use of my time. I asked him to tell me more about fear and sadness. I wanted to make sure I could rule those two things out. He told me that people whose default is fear tend to second-guess everything they do. They tend to be indecisive, and many end up leading very safe lives. They're not interested in risk or adventure. They're interested in sameness and security. They are people who typically do not switch careers midlife or go skydiving or take great risks. They are also conflict-averse. Yeah, no, I said, that's not me. I'm into conflict. The people who live in sadness tend to be depressives and can struggle with that their entire lives. They typically have huge amounts of empathy for others. These people also tend to love animals more than the average person loves animals. They're sensitive to others and are typically great listeners, but again, they can also have serious issues with depression. Yeah, I'm anger. Okay, so you're anger. Let's start there. He explained that the Enneagram system starts by identifying which of the three states of mind you are most closely aligned with and then broadens into a total of 9 different personality types. I can describe each type to you and we can try to figure out which one you are, which will help you understand why you do some of the things you do and what areas you can strengthen. That's called your growth edge. Dan went through each of the 9 personality types and told me to think of them like spokes on a wheel, which was also his analogy to meditation, spokes on a wheel. Start with your breath, then your hearing, your sight, and then keep going around the wheel to your internal organs and then your external body parts. I appreciated this because it was another visual aid, something I've learned over the years is the most effective way for me to digest a concept I'm unfamiliar with. Everything was all about spokes on a wheel. The wheel of awareness is what Dan called it. Dan liked wheels, and my guess is that in a past life, he drove a wagon on wheels. The Enneagram captured my interest because I respected the person who was telling me about it. When going through the 9 different personality types, you'll find that some include characteristics you recognize in yourself, but there are usually 1 or 2 traits that stand out as definitely not part of your personality. Ultimately, the number that describes you the most accurately is the one in which all the traits apply to you. There are tests you can take online to find your numbers, some more extensive than others, but it's ultimately about reading each number's strengths and weaknesses and being honest with yourself about yourself. Dan also explained that typically people feel drawn to 2 numbers at first. Then you revisit those 2 numbers, paying attention to the weaknesses of each. That's when you're usually able to discern which number more aptly describes you and lock into one of the numbers, which is what happened to me. When we got to number 7, I started to hear things that sounded a lot like me. 7, the enthusiast. The busy, variety-seeking type, spontaneous, versatile, acquisitive, and scattered. Type 7 in brief. 7s are extroverted, optimistic, versatile, and spontaneous. Playful, high-spirited, and practical, they can also misapply their many talents, becoming overextended, scattered, and undisciplined. They constantly seek new and exciting experiences, but can become distracted and exhausted by staying on the go. They typically have problems with impatience and impulsiveness. At their best, they focus their talents on worthwhile goals, becoming appreciative, joyous, and satisfied. Basic fear of a 7 is of being deprived and in pain. Basic desire to be satisfied and content, to have their needs fulfilled. Key motivations, want to maintain their freedom and happiness, to avoid missing out on worthwhile experiences, to keep themselves excited and occupied, to avoid and discharge pain. Type 7 sounded a lot like me until I heard the description of type 8 and realized that I'm not positive enough to be a 7. I'm more of a half-glass period person. I don't see a glass as half empty or half full. It's just half. It could go either way. 8, the challenger. The powerful, dominating type, self-confident, decisive, willful, and confrontational. Type 8s are self-confident, strong, and assertive, protective, resourceful, straight-talking, and decisive, but can also be egocentric and domineering. 8s feel they must control their environment, especially people, sometimes becoming confrontational and intimidating. 8s typically have problems with their tempers and with allowing themselves to be vulnerable. At their best, self-mastering, they use their strengths to improve others' lives, becoming heroic, magnanimous, and inspiring. Basic fear of being harmed or controlled by others. Basic desire to protect themselves, to be in control of their own life and destiny. Key motivations. Want to be self-reliant, to prove their strength and resist weakness, to be important in their world, to dominate the environment, and to stay in control of their situation. I'm an 8, I told Dan. Okay, you're an 8 then. Do you think I'm an 8? Well, that's the thing about the Enneagram, he said. You can't assess someone else. Each person has to assess themselves. That's what I do, I told Dan. I'm a fixer. I charge in and I clean up messes. Everyone's except my own. What are the bad qualities about being an 8? He reassured me that there were no bad numbers, and I reassured him that I wasn't sensitive enough to care if some numbers were bad or good, but that if we were going to work on my weaknesses, we needed to get real. Dan told me about a conference he attended where he sat alone with groups of only 7s or groups of only 8s and had asked them all what the best-kept secret of being that number was, the one thing that each number needed to work on the most. And? I asked him. All the 8s said their hidden secret is that 8s lack empathy, Dan said. Lack of empathy. Huh. Like a Republican? I had to think about the difference between empathy and sympathy. I can be too sympathetic to people. I'm a sucker for a sob story, and I will lavish sympathy on any stranger who needs a hand. But empathy? I had to talk that through with him. Empathy and sympathy, what's the distinction again? Sympathy is feeling bad for someone or for their situation, he told me. Sympathy is more like pity. Empathy is imagining what it's like to be in that person's shoes, thinking about what it feels like to be another person, and the understanding that their experiences and outlooks may have been unlike your own. Actually thinking about what it's like to be them. Dan asked me about those instances when I show up for the people I care about, and if, while I'm doing it, I think about what it feels like to be in that person's predicament. The answer was no. I went to their bedside or doorstep or lay in bed with any of my friends who needed a friend in order to do one thing, fix the situation. To show up repeatedly, time and time again, Whenever that happens, my sympathy's in full gear, but rarely, if ever, do I consider what it's like to be that person in that moment. I want to wrap their injury and patch them up. I never stop showing up, but I don't put myself in their shoes. Often we think we are showing up for someone when really all we're doing is showing everyone how great we are at showing up. Lack of empathy. That hit me over the head. I have no empathy. Yes, that's exactly right. Like how I feel about people who like room temperature water. Some people don't care about the temperature of their drink or the quality of ice. I don't understand those people. Like when flight attendants hand out room temperature Dasani water, I want to throw it out the airplane window. I've always looked sideways at this community of humans who are okay with room temperature water or, God forbid, prefer it. Or people who like pineapple on their pizza or, for that matter, any other hot food with pineapple on it. Rosemary annoys the shit out of me, too, but everyone else seems to fucking love it. Then again, I love cilantro, and people can have a visceral reaction to that, and I don't get that at all. How could anyone hate cilantro? It feels like I just need to meet more people who hate rosemary as much as I do. But mostly, everything and everyone at some point ends up annoying me. And now I know why. I'm not thinking about them. I've gone through life failing to understand why people have different reactions to things than I do. Lack of empathy made total sense. I never understand why everyone doesn't just do what I would do, get up and trudge on, power through. So I have sympathy, but not empathy. I also have zero sentimentality. It's almost like I'm allergic to it. Like when people talk about missing an old car or a home they've sold, I just want to tell them to please move on to the next topic quickly. I can't relate at all. I was on board with being an 8 who lacked empathy. Doorways in my brain were opening. I realized the hypocrisy of me espousing a philosophy that used a number to describe my personality, for fuck's sake. But I do feel passionately about takeaways, especially honest ones. And this was the first time a professional had told me something about myself that was negative. I had a takeaway. No empathy was huge. That was something tangible that I could learn from, a growth edge. I didn't care how hokey this sounded. The bottom line was that I had more information. Finding out what my weaknesses were opened the floodgates. Even if it's a theory or a little astrology or numerology adjacent, if it rings true with you, then it is true to you. And that's really all anyone needs in order to forge ahead and improve themselves. I needed to get past a roadblock, and understanding I had no empathy was a big first step. Metanoia, noun, a profound transformation in one's outlook. Usage. You'll need to rethink everything. Here, you'll need to resort to old-style metanoia, to radical rethinking and alteration. Finding out I lacked empathy was my metanoia. I spent the next few weeks recalling one instance after another where I now recognize my lack of empathy. I had been in London with one of my best friends who happens to be a gay man. We went to see the movie Call Me By Your Name, and 5 minutes in, I leaned over, irritated, and asked, "Is this a gay love story?" "Yes," he hissed incredulously. I hadn't known what the movie was about going in, and I was taken by surprise. "Oh my God, you're so selfish," I whispered loudly while I shoveled popcorn down my throat. The ludicrousness of my comment hit us both at the same time, and we started laughing so disruptively, we had to remove ourselves 10 minutes into the movie. Gay people have had to sit through straight people's stories since the beginning of time. Had I ever thought about that? Nope, never occurred to me. Lack of empathy was everywhere I went. This was an exciting development. I had been seeing Dan for just over a month, about 2 times a week, and I felt like I was making substantial progress in terms of not being reactive. I was now thinking about things before saying them, which prior to me seeing this doctor, I had never even contemplated as a possible way to behave. I was in a particularly good mood that day when I walked into his office, excited to tell him that I was getting somewhere with my behavior and that I actually enjoyed the 3-minute meditation I had done that morning and that I might even be ready to bump it up to 5 minutes. When I got to his office and sat down, Dan handed me an orange. "I felt like you might want an orange today. I picked it from my tree," he told me. This was the moment I became undone. In that moment, I fell apart at the proverbial seams. Shoulders down, head bowed. I sat and cried and shook and let my shoulders feel sorry for themselves, and my heart ached and I moaned loudly, like a wounded wolf, one with an injury that had scabbed over many times but had never properly healed. I had a deep infection. My crying was acute, hysterical. It was the kind of guttural pain that could land you in the hospital. I cried and cried and cried, all while peeling my orange, with Dan sitting there looking at me like he'd expected this all along. He handed me a box of tissues, which I used to clean up the juice that was squirting everywhere, because apparently peeling an orange was another simple task that I had somehow magically forgotten how to do and had instead been stabbing it with my fingernails. I wanted to charge past my tears to stop myself from crying in front of him, or anyone for that matter, but he left me with no other avenues. I had no choice but to give in and let it rip and let him watch me crumble. Foam at the mouth, snot out of the nose kind of crying. Nothing I'd ever want another person to see me do. All while still trying to maintain some sort of dignity by continuing to eat my orange, which was a mess with the makeshift plate I had made out of the tissues. And when I felt more tears coming my way, I gave up the life raft. I put the tissues and the half-molested orange in my lap and looked at his trustworthy, smarter-than-me eyes and saw in them what I had been longing for all along. Pity. After 30 years of bottling up the deepest injury of my life, I was ready for someone to feel sorry for me. We had met in a different room that day. Dan's regular office was being used by someone else, so he warned me at our last appointment that we would have to meet in his other office, which we hadn't done before. I remember thinking, what kind of basket case does he think I am that he has to warn me about sitting in a different office? I don't know if it was the change of scenery, or if it was because the light was different, or that we were sitting at a table rather than in our regular two chairs, or if it was that simple act of kindness of him giving me an orange he had picked from his tree that elicited such a primal reaction inside me. When I was finally able to collect myself, I said, "There's nothing I hate more than room temperature fruit, and I almost never eat carbs, but I'm going to eat this orange, and thank you for bringing it to me." "You're welcome." Then I exhaled for about 10 minutes straight, putting myself back together. And when I was finally able to breathe normally again, he asked me what I was feeling. "Anger," I sobbed. "I'm so angry and I'm so tired." "I bet," he said. "I bet you are. I need to tell you about the day my brother died and what happened to my family." Death Valley. My brother was the first man I ever slept with. The night I came home from the hospital, my mom said that Chet, who was 13 at the time, asked if he could sleep with me, to which my mom agreed. Over the years, he told the story of not being able to sleep that whole night for fear of rolling over and crushing me. The better question I've always thought was why either of my parents allowed a 13-year-old boy to sleep with a 2-day-old baby. That should give you some insight into how interested my parents were in raising children, or for that matter, using protection. They had 6 children, and it's a miracle any of us are still breathing. I heard him taking 2 steps at a time up to my mom's room, so I ducked my head under the covers where I was snuggling with my mom in our usual spot. My mom was the definition of a snuggler, and she always had some form of chocolate close by, a Snickers or an Almond Joy or a brownie wrapped in cellophane. Lying in bed with her was like sleeping with cotton candy. "Where is she?" Chet asked menacingly when he bombed through the bedroom door, smelling like the woods. My brother always smelled like a bonfire. He smelled like the beach and the woods all at the same time. He smelled like home. "She's not here," my mom sang in the sing-song flirty way she spoke when she was being playful, which was a large percentage of the time. "I don't believe you," he told her, and then pinpointed exactly where my feet were, grabbed them and dragged me out of the bed until he was holding me upside down by my ankles with my head an inch above the floor. I used my arms to climb up his legs, and then he spun me around until I was over his shoulders. "Be careful, Chet," my mom scolded my brother, which was silly because A, she knew I loved this, and B, my mother telling any of us to be careful didn't even go in one ear and out the other. It just turned around and went right back into her mouth. "What's for dinner?" he asked me as we bounded down the steps to the kitchen. It was 10 p.m., and whenever Chet came home from work that late, he wanted cereal. When I was 9 years old, preparing cereal felt culinary and also made me feel like I was running a household, which no one else in my family seemed to be doing at that point. I fancied myself a homemaker, taking care of my brood. Being the youngest of 6 doesn't beg a lot of service from your siblings. No one ever asked me for anything, but Chet did. I loved making him cereal when he came home late. I could make any kind of cereal. I knew the right milk-to-cereal ratio he preferred, so I'd fold a paper towel into a napkin. My parents had either never heard about napkins or they were able to buy paper towels cheaper and in bulk, and place a cereal spoon beside the bowl because, unlike anyone else in our family, I knew the difference between a cereal spoon and a teaspoon. To this day, I always prefer a cereal spoon, even when I'm drinking tea. Then we'd sit at the kitchen table and talk about our day, like a couple. My brother Chet was the oldest, then 22, and I was the youngest. I was his little plaything. I knew that the more outrageous I was, the more he would howl, and I loved the feeling of making him howl, with his head thrown back, laughing. Chet was tall and skinny, but strong enough to throw me over his shoulders. I always braced myself when I saw him charge through a room, headed in my direction with his eyes dancing. I'd try to duck or run, but would freeze in the end, covering my head in my hands, kicking and screaming, only to be thrown up over his shoulders and taken somewhere that I pretended I didn't want to go. I wanted to go everywhere with him. He could build a shed, he could sail a boat, and he could fix a car, three things my father could never do but pretended to do frequently.